Chapter 24. A small van, marked with the name of a well-known express package company, drove up a ramp and stopped at the shipping and receiving door of a sizable one-story concrete building. The structure covered one city block of a huge warehouse complex near Galveston, Texas. There was no company sign on the roof or walls. The only evidence that it was occupied came from a small brass plaque beside the door that read, Logan Storage Company. It was just after 6 o'clock in the evening. Too late for employees to be working on the job, but still early enough not to arouse the suspicion of the patrolling security guards. Without exiting the van, the driver punched in a code on a remote control box that deactivated the security alarm and raised the big door. As it rose to the ceiling, it revealed the interior of a vast storehouse, filled to the roof support girders with seemingly endless racks packed with furniture and ordinary household goods. There was no hint of life anywhere on the spacious concrete floor. Now assured that all employees had left for home, the driver moved the van inside and waited for the door to close. Then he drove onto a platform scale large enough to hold an 18-wheel truck and trailer. He stepped from the vehicle and walked over to a small instrument panel on a pedestal and pressed a code into a switch labeled Engage Weigh-In. The platform vibrated and then began to sink beneath the floor, revealing itself to be a huge freight elevator. After it settled onto the basement floor, the driver eased the van into a large tunnel, while behind him the elevator automatically returned to the upper storage floor. The tunnel stretched for nearly a full kilometer before ending deep beneath the main floor of another huge warehouse. Here, in a vast subterranean complex, the Zolar family conducted their criminal operations, while operating as a legitimate business on the main floor. On the honest business level, regular employees entered a glass entrance to administration offices that ran along one entire wall of the building. The rest of the spacious floor housed thousands of valuable paintings, sculptures, and a great variety of antiques. All had impeccably bona fide origins and were legally purchased and sold on the open market. A separate department at the rear housed the preservation department, where a small team of master craftsmen worked to restore damaged art and ancient artifacts to their original splendor. None of the employees of Zolar International or Logan Storage Company, even those with 20 years of service or more, remotely suspected the great clandestine operation that took place beneath their feet. The driver exited the tunnel and entered an enormous, sprawling, secret sub-basement, whose interior floor space was even larger than the main surface level 20 meters, 66 feet, above. About two-thirds of the area was devoted to the accumulation, storage, and eventual sale of stolen and smuggled artworks. The remaining third was set aside for the Zolar family's thriving artifact forgery and fabrication program. This subterranean level was known only to the immediate members of the Zolar family, a few loyal co-partners in the operation, and the original construction crew, who were brought in from Russia and then returned when the subterranean rooms were completed, so no outsiders could reveal the facility's existence. The driver slipped from behind the steering wheel, walked around to the rear of the van, and pulled a long metal cylinder from inside that was attached to a cart whose wheels automatically unfolded once it was pulled free, like an ambulance gurney. When all four wheels were extended, he rolled the cart and cylinder across the huge basement toward a closed room. As he pushed, the van driver stared at his reflection in the polished metal of the cylinder. He was of average height with a well-rounded stomach. He looked heavier than his actual weight because of a tight-fitting pair of white coveralls. His medium brown hair was clipped short in a military crew cut, and his cheeks and chin were closely shaven. He found it amusing that his shamrock green eyes took on a silver tint from the aluminum container. Now deceptively dreamy, they could turn as hard as flint when he was angry or tense. A police detective, good at providing accurate descriptions, would have described Charles Zolar, legal name Charles Oxley, as a con man who did not look like a con man. His brothers, Joseph Zolar and Cyrus Saracen, opened the door and stepped from the room to affectionately embrace him. "Congratulations," said Saracen. "A remarkable triumph of subterfuge." Zolar nodded. "Our father couldn't have planned a smoother theft. You've done the family proud." "Praise indeed," Oxley said, smiling. "You don't know how happy I am to finally deliver the mummy to a safe place." "Are you certain no one saw you remove it from Rummel's building or followed you across the country?" asked Saracen. Oxley stared at him. "You insult my capabilities, brother. I took all the required precautions and drove to Galveston during daylight business hours over secondary roads. I was especially careful not to break any traffic laws. Trust me when I say I wasn't followed." "Pay no heed to Cyrus," said Zolar, smiling. "He tends to be paranoid when it comes to covering our tracks." "We've come too far to make a mistake now," Saracen said in a low voice. Oxley peered behind his brothers into the reaches of the vast storage room. "Are the glyph experts here?" Saracen nodded. "A professor of anthropology from Harvard who has made pre-Columbian ideographic symbols his life's work, and his wife, who handles the computer end of their decoding program, Henry and Mickey Moore. Do they know where they are?" Zolar shook his head. "They've been wearing blindfolds and listening to cassette players ever since our agents picked them up in a limo at their condo in Boston. After they were airborne in a chartered jet, the pilot was instructed to circle around for 2 hours before flying to Galveston. They were brought here from the airport in a soundproof delivery truck. It's safe to say they haven't seen or heard a thing. So, for all they know, they're in a research laboratory somewhere in California or Oregon." "That's the impression laid on them during the flight," replied Saracen. "They must have asked questions." "At first," answered Zolar, "but when our agents informed them they would receive $250,000 in cash for decoding an artifact, the Moors promised their full cooperation. They also promised to keep their lips sealed." "And you trust them?" Oxley asked dubiously. Saracen smiled malevolently. "Of course not." Oxley didn't have to read minds to know that Henry and Mickey Moore would soon be names on a tombstone. "No sense in wasting more time, brothers," he said. "Where do you want General Nimlap's mummy?" Saracen gestured toward one section of the underground facility. "We've partitioned a special room. I'll show you the way while Brother Joseph escorts our experts." He hesitated, pulled three black ski masks from his coat pocket and flipped one to Oxley. "Put that on. We don't want them to see our faces." "Why bother? They won't live to identify us." "To intimidate them." "A little extreme, but I guess you have a point." While Zolar guided the Moors to the enclosed room, Oxley and Saracen carefully removed the golden mummy from the container and laid it on a table covered with several layers of velvet padding. The room had been furnished with a small kitchen, beds, and a bathroom. A large desk was set with note and sketch pads, and several magnifying glasses with varied degrees of magnification. There was also a computer terminal with a laser printer loaded with the proper software. An array of overhead spotlights was positioned to accent the images engraved on the golden bodysuit. When the Moores entered the room, their headsets and blindfolds were removed. "I trust you were not too uncomfortable," said Zolar courteously. The Moores blinked under the bright lights and rubbed their eyes. Henry Moore looked and acted the role of an Ivy League professor. He was aging gracefully with a slim body, a full head of shaggy gray hair, and the complexion of a teenage boy. Dressed in a tweed jacket with leather patches on the sleeves, he wore his school tie knotted under the collar of a dark green cotton shirt. As an added touch, he sported a small white carnation in his lapel. Mickey Moore was a good 15 years younger than her husband. Like him, she had a slender figure, almost as thin as the 70s-era fashion model she had once been. Her skin was on the dark side, and the high, rounded cheekbones suggested American Indian genes somewhere in her ancestry. She was a good-looking woman, beautifully poised, with an elegance and regal bearing that made her stand out at university cocktail and dinner parties. Her gray eyes focused and then darted from one masked brother to another before coming to rest on the golden bodysuit of Tia Pollo. "A truly magnificent piece of work," she said softly. "You never fully described what it was you wanted my husband and me to decipher." "We apologize for the melodramatic precautions," Zolar said sincerely. "But, as you can see, this Inca artifact is priceless. And until it is fully examined by experts such as you, we do not wish word of its existence to reach certain people who might attempt to steal it." Henry Moore ignored the brothers and rushed to the table. He took a pair of reading glasses from a case in his breast pocket, slid them over his nose, and peered closely at the glyphs on one arm of the suit. "Remarkable detail," he said admiringly. "Except for textiles and a few pieces of pottery, this is the most extensive display of iconography I've ever seen produced on any object from the late Horizon era." "Do you see any problem in deciphering the images?" asked Zolar. "It will be a labor of love," said Moore, without taking his eyes from the golden suit. "But Rome wasn't built in a day. It will be a slow process." Saracen was impatient. "We need answers as soon as possible." "You can't rush me," Moore said indignantly. "Not if you want an accurate version of what the images tell us." "He's right," said Oxley. "We can't afford faulty data." "The Moors are being well paid for their efforts," Saracen said sternly. "Misinterpretations will cancel all payment." Anger rising, Moore snapped, "Misinterpretations, indeed! You're lucky my wife and I accepted your proposal. One look at what's on the table, and we're aware of the reasons behind your juvenile hocus-pocus games. Running around with masks over your faces as if you were holding up a bank. Total and utter nonsense." "What are you saying?" Saracen demanded. "Any historian worth his salt knows the golden bodysuit of Tia Pollo was stolen from Spain in the 1920s and never recovered. How do you know this isn't another one that was recently discovered?" Moore pointed to the first image of a panel that traveled from the left shoulder to the hand. "The symbol of a great warrior, a Chachapoyan general known as Naimlap, who served the great Inca ruler Huascar. Legend claims he stood as high as any modern star basketball player and had blonde hair, blue eyes, and fair skin. Judging from the size of the golden suit and my knowledge of its history, there is no doubt that this is Naimlap's mummy." Saracen moved close to the anthropologist. "You and your wife just do your job. No mistakes. No more lectures." Zolar quickly stepped in to defuse what was rapidly developing into a nasty confrontation. "Please excuse my associate, Dr. Moore. I apologize for his rude behavior, but I think you understand that we're all a little excited about finding the golden suit. You're quite right. This is Naimlap's mummy." "How did you come by it?" asked Moore. I can't say, but I will promise you that it is going back to Spain as soon as it has been fully studied by experts such as you and your wife. A canny smile curled Moore's lips. Very scrupulous of you, whatever your name is, to send it back to its rightful owners. But not before my wife and I decode the instructions leading to Huascar's treasure. Oxley muttered something unintelligible under his breath as Saracen stepped toward Moore. But Zolar stretched out an arm and held him back. You see through our masquerade. I do. Shall I assume you wish to make a counter-proposal, Dr. Moore? Moore glanced at his wife. She looked strangely withdrawn. Then he turned to Zolar. If our expertise leads you to the treasure, I don't think a 20% share is out of line. The brothers stared at one another for several moments, considering. Oxley and Zolar couldn't see Saracen's face behind the ski mask, but they could see their brother's eyes blaze with fury. Zolar nodded. Considering the potential for incredible riches, I do believe Dr. Moore is being quite generous. I agree, said Oxley. All things considered, the good professor's offer is not exorbitant. He held out his hand. You and Mrs. Moore have a deal. If we find the treasure, your share is 20%. Moore shook hands. He turned to his wife and smiled as if blissfully unaware of their death sentence. Well, my dear, shall we get to work?